Well, we have been working our way through the book of Isaiah, and we had noted the last time we were in the text, as we started chapter 40, that there is a difference between what came before and what begins now, and there's a difference of focus and emphasis. And you may recall that the end of chapter 39 was a recognition of the Babylonian captivity that was to come. And chapter 40, beginning with the first part of it, was acknowledging a need for comfort to the people in light of what was coming. And there was somewhat of an anticipation of a focus on the present need, but also a future need for comfort and deliverance as it related to that coming Babylonian captivity. So as we've been thinking about this new section of Isaiah, there's been a change. The first 39 chapters were basically dealing with judgment, and now there's a change from the judgment to the hope of comfort and deliverance. And then as we're looking at the chapter 40, it has some additional parts as well. Chapter 40, the first few verses, verses 1 through 11, are recognizing the Lord's intention to intervene in history. In light of this Babylonian captivity that's was predicted in chapter 39, now there's a matter of, how is the Lord going to deal with that? Is he going to deal with that? What is his desire? What is his intention in light of that? Is he concerned about delivering them from that horrible condition? Because you recall that the people of Judah had just recently seen what happened to the northern kingdom. It was taken into captivity just prior to that to Assyria, and other people were brought in, so that the land was divided and was in the minds of the people of Judah polluted because of bringing in pagans and mixing them with them. And so the question is going to be, well, are we going to suffer the same fate? Are we going to end up in the same place where our nation is going to be essentially dissolved? And that's going to be the end of us. Is there any hope? And so the first part of chapter 40 is saying, yes, God does have a desire to provide deliverance and comfort, and there is hope, and that is what his intention is. So that's kind of giving the what of his intention. And then the second part of chapter 40, that what we're going to be looking at today, verses 12 through 31, is giving the why. Why can the Lord so intervene in history to bring about some kind of deliverance, to be able to offer comfort when what is told them is coming and what they have observed of their sister nation is not looking good? And so they needed some encouragement. And we have also observed along the way, we can relate to some of that, because as we think about our own context and we see what's going on in our nation and we see things moving in a direction that is greatly disturbing, we may be wondering the same thing. Is the Lord still faithful? Is there still hope? What's going to happen? How are we going to deal with this? But what we want to recognize is Isaiah is going to be bringing up a number of questions that he's going to be asking, and in a rhetorical sense, and then providing answers. And he's going to be doing it from the perspective of what is God like. And if the first part is what is God's intention, what is his desire, the second part is what is his ability, what can he do, why should we trust him, why should we see him as a faithful God, that's what is going to be communicated here. And so he's going to be shown as the sole creator, and he is infinitely greater than any of these other nations that are out there, anything greater than anything else in the world itself. And so you can be confident in him. And that's a picture that we need to hear in our day as well. So we come to the first part here, verses 12 through 20, and note that he is the incomparable creator. There is no one like him. And so we begin with these questions. Who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, measured heaven with a span, and calculated the dust of the earth in a measure, weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance? Who has directed the Spirit of the Lord, or as his counselor has taught him? With whom did he take counsel, and who instructed him and taught him in the path of justice? Who taught him knowledge and showed him the way of understanding? Now again, these are more rhetorically oriented questions to get his people to think about who they're dealing with. And so the first thing that we want to note here is that he has ultimate creative power and unaided knowledge. So we recognize that the Lord can precisely measure all that he has created. And that's kind of a part of the picture that is communicated here, talking about measuring the waters in the hollow of his hand and heaven with a span and calculated the dust of the earth and weighing the mountains in scales. Who has a handle on that? Have you ever thought about trying to measure the weight of a mountain? Now, it's been done because people calculate, you know, size and mass and all this kind of stuff, and they come up with guesstimates to try to do that. Does the Lord know? Well, absolutely. He reminds us he knows the hairs on our heads, and some of us try to keep that interesting in terms of we're losing them all the time, you know, just to see if he can keep up with us. But he has that ability to be able to know all that because he made it all. He's responsible for every element that there is and all of that. But you think about us. I mean, we struggle to precisely measure most anything. It has been said, and you may have observed, that you know what time it is unless you have two watches, because they may not be exactly the same. It's like, now, which one is really correct? Which one is accurate? Or I have at least four thermometers around my house, inside, outside, and it's like, what temperature is it really? I mean, in the front of the house, it says this. In the back of the house, it says this. Now, which one is it? And the electronic one says this, the physical one, all of that. So we struggle to come up with measurements, but that's not a problem for the Lord. And he may not be as concerned about what the temperature is as some of us are. But what's interesting when you look at this text and the questions here, it's talking about waters and the heavens. Does that ring a bell? Does that bring you back to Genesis chapter 1? And the waters separated from the expanse, or sometimes use the word firmament, isn't that kind of a picture there? And then the dust versus a mountain, I mean, the smallest element to the largest element. It's like, this is very specific. This is well thought out. So it's thinking about the totality of God's world that he has made, and noting something about the workmanship in it all, and he knows all about it. It's not a surprise to him. And it kind of reminds us of Job chapter 38 and on, where God is asking the questions, where were you when I did this? And where were you when I did this? And how do you deal with, did you know this? You know, all of the things that he made. And so it's pointing out that he is not only the Lord of all, he is the creator of all. And this emphasizes something of his omnipotence and his immensity. He is above and beyond all and is responsible for all. And the Lord has no need for external input of any kind. And we make a good contrast to that because we are dependent on lots of input in a lot of ways. And the one way that you may try to minimize how much input you need is if you were to go backpacking, where you take everything with you, you're totally self-sufficient, at least that's the idea, but then guess what? You can only last out there for so long before you need some other input. So even that is only temporary. But God doesn't have that problem. And it's hard for us to even think about God in that light, because everything we have to deal with, we need to rely on something or someone else to give us input. And the idea here is that God had all the knowledge, all the wisdom that he needed to be able to put all of this together. And so it was not a difficulty for him. It was not a challenge or a problem in any way. And within the confines of the Trinity that were involved in the whole process of creation, God had it all figured out. And just think for a moment about one little thing, like DNA. How long did it take us to figure that out? And do we have it figured out? And I think we're still working on that. We're still trying to figure out the things. And the Lord came up with that. How quickly? Was he sitting in his laboratory calculating and working on things and consulting encyclopedias and all that sort of stuff? He didn't have to deal with any of that. But we do, and it takes us a while. So just the thought of who we're dealing with, he had everything that he needed. And he came up with it by the word of his mouth. And it's all very complicated for us, but not for him. And so this has his omniscience in view. Then looking at verses 15 through 17. Behold, the nations are as a drop in a bucket, and are counted as the small dust on the scales. Look, he lifts up the isles as a very little thing. And Lebanon is not sufficient to burn, nor its beasts sufficient for a burnt offering. All nations before him are as nothing, and they are counted by him less than nothing and worthless. Ooh, I guess that kind of puts things in perspective. When you read that, it's like, wait a minute. What are you saying? Who are you talking about? Are you thinking about us? Do we fit in that picture? The nations are as a drop in a bucket? Well, we're seeing a contrast again here. He has ultimate worth and incomparable value. And the nations of the earth are kind of set up as a comparison. So we see the human nations are insignificant in contrast to the Lord. And what you see, if you're looking at the first few verses that we just looked at and compared to this, he's starting off by looking at the physical world, and then he's going down to the human world and noting something about mankind in relation to him. So the product of creation, the people that are in it and all of that, as well as the process of creation, all reflect something on God's immensity and his greatness. And all of the people on the earth at any given time don't compare to him in any way, in knowledge, in understanding, in power, authority. And yet, we're so familiar with people and nations, and that's what we relate to. And there are many people who have no concept of God in terms of an acknowledgement of him. They have an internal concept that they suppress, but they don't acknowledge him. And so all they can think about is people and powers that be. And that's why they get so freaked out about the possibility that this planet might be self-destructing because of our input on it. because that's all there is. But this is telling us this isn't all there is. This is a drop in the bucket. This is the nations and peoples. If we think we can stop global warming, who do we think we are? Do you know what you're dealing with? Do you know who you're dealing with? That's part of the picture here. And he's talking about people, and he's putting things in perspective and saying there is nothing and no one in creation, no human beings that are a challenge to the Creator. I mean, we may think we are. And so this is something about his sovereignty that is in view. And we'll see more on that. The human nations have no worth apart from the Lord. Now try telling that to any of the nations on the earth. Like, you are worthless. Really? I don't think so. I think we're worth billions in this way or that way. But this is, again, putting it in perspective. Do you know who you're dealing with? The nations arrogantly think that they are sovereign. I mean, isn't that one of the issues that England is dealing with in the whole Brexit thing? I mean, they recognize that they have lost something of their sovereignty because of being connected with the European Union, and so now that's not the direction they're wanting to go, but now they're so deep into it, they find it's kind of hard, if not impossible, to get out of it because they've given up more than what they know what to do with. And that, again, is just an indication of the frailty of humanity. And, again, realizing the people that are on the earth have no worth apart from the fact that God created them in his image. And if it weren't for that, they would have no worth. That's the significance. Because when we think about comparing ourselves to him, I mean, think about some of the leaders on the earth today who want you to think that they are in control. Now, does that take much of your thinking to come up with somebody? I mean, what about the current leader of North Korea? Is he trying to exercise a little bit of sovereignty? Does he think he's got everything under control? And what about that other guy in Moscow? Is he in control? And we could say, what about those who are leaders in our country? Do they think they're in control? Well, if they're honest, they would say no. But generally speaking, the inclination is to think that, you know, I'm making all the decisions, I've got everything under control, but we know that's not the case. We know who does and who does not. So, again, it's putting things in perspective, who is ultimately in control. Then looking at verses 18 through 20, to whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare to him? The workman molds an image. The goldsmith overspreads it with gold, and the silversmith casts silver chains. Whoever is too impoverished for such a contribution chooses a tree that will not rot. He seeks for himself a skillful workman to prepare a carved image that will not totter. Now think about the imagery that's communicated there. The idea of trying to make an image to have a some tangible view of a god or the god or some variation of various gods that have been done throughout much of history. And what we see is that he has incomparable identity and an irreproducible nature. There's something about him that you can't really identify him. And there's something about his nature that you can't duplicate in any way. It's interesting to think about that. There's no image that can adequately depict the Lord. And that has been graphically portrayed in my thinking anytime I try to find some picture to put on a slide that would give us some a way of imaging the God of the universe. I mean, the closest I can come to is something that's like the sky, because you can't come up with anything. And that's not focused on any particular object up there. It's just that he's out there somewhere, and we can't really get a handle on what he looks like. And there is or ought to be a hesitancy to try to image God in any specific and tangible form, because there really isn't anything we can come up with that would adequately do it. I mean, the Israelites tried that when Moses was up on the mountain and Aaron was down below, and the people came up to him and said, well, I don't know what's happened to Moses, but we need to come up with something a little more tangible here, because you know, we need something we can see. And then we can really worship, or at least have a party, which is what they ended up doing. So how do you picture the transcendent God who is not comparable to anything out there? I was recently talking to a brother of mine, my oldest brother, and he had mentioned that he recently got a 3D printer, just to kind of mess with it and have some fun with it. And it was explaining to me how it worked and so on. You've got some kind of the basic material, and then you have some kind of filler, and they both have to go in because you need to have something that goes in the place in this 3D printer so that when you have your part that comes out of it, you need to have something that gives some form for the empty spaces, so to speak, and so that's the filler, and there's this thing. And he said, you can come up with some neat things, but there are limits as to what you can do, but to some degree, it's whatever your imagination can come up with. And so I was thinking, you know, you would think if you had a printer that you could imagine just about anything, that you might be able to imagine God and you could reproduce him. 3D. Is that possible? Not a chance. There is no way. No matter how much imagination we come up with, we can't reproduce anything comparable to him, let alone even identify exactly what he's like. I mean, we have a lot of input, but we still come away with no way to put him into some form of a tangible nature. The closest we can come is found in the New Testament. Like in the Gospel of John, it says, basically, paraphrase, if you want to see God, just look at me, Jesus says. That ought to be close enough. But then you have the problem, well, what did Jesus look like? Was he some hippie from the 60s? I mean, where do you get those pictures? You know, I have a hesitancy to use pictures depicting Jesus for that reason. It's like, I can't really come up with it. Anyway, that's another whole matter. But we just have no way of trying to accurately duplicate something of his nature. And there's no material of sufficient quality to depict the Lord. I mean, we can think about some of the things that we have. If you think about the most valuable materials or the strongest materials, you know, whether it be gold or titanium or whatever, is there anything of a sufficient quality even that we could depict? And this passage gives us some examples of things, you know, working with gold or silver. Or if somebody doesn't have enough money to come up with gold or silver, they'll take a tree and they'll try to pick a tree that's not going to be easily rotted so that it'll last. And then if possible, to secure it some way so it doesn't fall over. If you recall the account of the Philistines when they took the Ark of the Covenant and they put it in their temple of Dagon, and in the morning Dagon's head falls off and arms fall off and everything. It's like, that wasn't much of a god you had there. It's not very stable. So, you know, we try to come up with things, and that's the picture that's communicating there. You can't come up with any material. You can't come up with any kind of image that can depict the living and true God of the universe. And the Bible tells us, don't even try, because it's not something we can even come up with. Because anything we come up with will be wrong. It'll be faulty. It will be an improper imaging of the God of the universe. But if you think about what is an idol, an idol could be anything that is made to replace or put in the place of God, whether it's try to picture him or any substitute. And there's a few things that are part of our culture and have been for many years that have been suggested as in some form an idol. And one of them is secularism, because it's basically putting man in the place of God as the ultimate, sort of that center, and that's not adequate. Or there are alternative spiritualities, whether it be cults or other religions or isms that are out there. None of them work. None of them are adequate. And the thing is that God loves both the rationalist and the pagan. And his desire is that none should perish, but that all should come to repentance. And we need to realize the people that we deal with who have bought into secularism, humanism, any of the other isms that are out there, they need the Lord. He's concerned about them, and we ought to be as well. So then, continuing on, looking at verses 21 through 26, he is the incomparable sovereign. We've kind of already started moving in the direction of something regarding his sovereignty, looking at verses 21 and 22. Have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundation of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. Now, there's some interesting things found in this passage, and this passage has been a source of some study for some physicists thinking about the nature of the earth and its creation. And so there's some interesting observations we could make here. But the point that we want to note is that he has insuppressible presence and unsurpassed creative design. The Lord's presence is manifest in the world. The knowledge of the Lord is not without sufficient revelation. We've seen that. Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Romans 1 says that his invisible attributes are known by all, and there's no one without excuse. There's no excuse for not recognizing that he's there, other than the fact that people suppress, and that's what's pointed out in that text as well. So there's ample information, and any kind of observation should acknowledge that there has to be someone to account for all that is. And there are testimonies of people in whom the Lord has worked to bring about salvation as we respond to the message of the gospel, that we know the Lord. We should acknowledge that. And we have a testimony to be able to share that the presence of God, if we're a believer, if we put our faith and trust in Christ, the presence of God resides in us. Paul said, are you not aware that you are the temple of the Holy Spirit? So there's a testimony there. In addition to the biblical record that testifies of God's reality and his presence and everything about him from beginning to end, So technically, the presence of anything in the universe should cause one to ask questions like, why is there something instead of nothing? How did everything come to be? Why is it here? Where is it going? And there's really no other explanation of the cosmology of the presence of the world that's adequate. But the scriptures do give us that. The design of creation is not without sufficient revelation. And as I've noted, some have looked at this text and have made some observations. It's pictured from the idea of the Lord looking down on things, and it communicates something of his transcendence. He's above and beyond, but he's also personal enough that he's interested in and interacts. The word that's used here and with regard to the circle of the earth, verse 22, he who sits above the circle of the earth, some have wondered exactly what is that saying. The Hebrew word is kug, and it has something to do with the form of the earth, and I thought it was an interesting observation, and I haven't really looked to see the details of it. But the word for ball in German is Kugel, as in Kugelschreiber, to write with a ball, a ballpoint pen. And there may be, because there's obvious overlaps in languages, there may be a connection there as well. But the real emphasis here is on the idea of the heavens being stretched out. And that has been used to distinguish the Big Bang from the creation account. And the Big Bang has the idea of the earth is, or the universe is expanding. It's in the process of moving out, but it seems more like it has been expanded. It has been moved out and put in place, and then it stopped. And it's not continuing in that sense, which would be consistent with the account of Genesis chapter 1, where it talks about the water and the expanse being separated. And then the seventh day, the work was done. And there's been discussion on dealing with the problem of starlight and time. If the stars are that far away, how can there take millions of years to get there unless there is the factor of time dilation associated with the expanded universe? And so you can look at Russ Humphrey's book, Starlight and Time, if you want to look into some more details. There are others who have also dealt with that issue. All that to say, this text is one of the texts that is specifically looked at to deal with that issue of the expanded universe. So something else to keep in mind. Then verses 23 to 24 says, he brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth useless. Scarcely shall they be planted. Scarcely shall they be sown. Scarcely shall their stock take root in the earth. When he will also blow on them, they will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. And here we have, again, a reference to the larger universe and then looking at the people within it who think that they're in control of things. And the emphasis here is he has ultimate control over all human authorities. And that is something that we recognize if we take the scriptural viewpoint of things, but the people on the earth are not going to be eager to admit that they don't have ultimate authority. The human rulers on the earth have no ultimate authority. They may think they do, whether they have positions of authority or have some given office or they're the decision makers of the world. They may appear to wield power, but we see many other passages in Scripture which note that the Lord directs the kings of the earth. He is directing how things go, and He is the ultimate enthroned authority. No one else has a position that even comes close. And He is able to dispose of or depose any human leader, which also gives us maybe some perspective when there are leaders that find themselves in positions of authority in our world, in our nation, in our day, and we wonder how on earth did they get in to that place of authority and power? And what's going to happen? I mean, some have wondered, you know, how did we get the leader we've got in our state right now? Is that going the way we wanted? Are the decisions that are being made now the ones that we want to have made? And on and on, you can think about that. But if the Lord is ultimately in control, then we have to say, well, maybe we're getting what we deserve. Does that mean we don't have to try to do everything we can for the sake of what's right and good? No, we need to do everything we can. But we have to deal with what we have as well. And the Apostle Paul and the people of Jesus' day had to deal with Rome and all that was there. And that was not exactly a godly nation that they were dealing with. So some perspective is kind of helpful. So the point is, we don't need to be intimidated by the rulers of the world because of who the ultimate authority is. And we know that, but there are days when we may not be acting in light of that. We need to remember who is in control and who we are trusting in light of that. The human rulers on earth have no ultimate security. The Lord can blow them away at any moment. That's the picture that's communicated there with the imagery. He will also blow on them, and they will wither. That's kind of communicating something that they're not quite as tough as they think they are. And we can be encouraged by that. And He can move them out of the way just as easily as He allows them to be in place. Then verses 25 to 26, again, some more questions. To whom then will you liken me? Or to whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One? And this is putting it in the Lord's words, not just Isaiah's words here. Slight change of focus from the previous reference that was comparable. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things, who brings out their host by number. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of His might and the strength of His power. No one is missing. Here we see He has unparalleled knowledge and power over the heavens. The Lord is completely unique and beyond all comparison. And we need to see something about what is communicated here about His person. He is infinitely superior to anyone else that we can think of, whether it be related to His power, His wisdom, His dignity, His sovereignty, His authority, or His holiness. You think about the various gods that have been suggested historically. Zeus, Diana, Baal, Ashtaroth, Chemosh. I mean, you just go down through the list. Were any of those like really superior in holiness? Was that even a category that they were associated with? Probably not. So there really isn't anything that compares. And the other thing that's noted here, He has complete control over the hosts of the heaven. You need to think back to in the Babylonian and Canaanite times, the objects of the heavens were worshipped and have been, still are in many ways. And they were alternate gods that were suggested. And what we're seeing communicated here is that they are nothing. God knows them all by name. He has authority over them. He has put them in place. They don't compare to him at all. You people are wasting your time thinking that the bodies that are in the heavens have any comparison to the Lord of all, the God of the universe. So forget about it. I mean, if you've ever looked into the heavens and have seen the immensity of the heavens, and then trying to think of naming every dot that's up there, I think we would run out of names in very short order before we even came close to seeing a rational listing of all that's there. But God can do that. He has that all under control. So there's a sense in which we ought to be overwhelmed by the incredible immensity of God in light of every other thing that's out there. He is superior to the nations. He is superior to the idols. He's superior to the rulers. He's superior to any of the other suggested deities that are out there. That's what's being communicated in this text. So the two sections we've looked at so far are focused on the superior nature of God over everything that's out there. The next section we're going to look at as we finish up this text is going to be sort of taking it home and bringing it down to, well, so what? What difference does that make as it relates to the people of Judah? Or we would say, what difference does it make to us? How do we deal with that? And so here the focus is going to be more on the practical implications. And so we want to see that. So he is the dependable Lord. And there are probably many different thoughts that could be brought out in terms of the use of the word Lord there, as in the master, the creator, the overall person. But the emphasis that we want to think about for this section is on the covenant-keeping God. That's the focus. And the name Yahweh is generally associated with that in his relation to his people. And that's what we see starting in verse 27. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and my just claim is passed over by my God? What's the concern there? God has forgotten us. Look at what problems we are facing. You're not paying attention to us. Verse 28, have you not known, have you not heard? The everlasting God, the Lord, Yahweh, the creator of the ends of the earth, neither faints nor is weary. His understanding is unsearchable. You can't get away from him. He has not forgotten you. That's the picture. And so then we recognize he has not given up on his covenant people because he is in covenant relationship with them. The people were discouraged about their serious plight. They have been through a lot of difficulty. They've had to deal with their beloved nation being divided and having crummy kings for the most part. In the northern kingdom, all of them were bad. In the southern kingdom, it was more split. And then Israel goes into captivity. Judah is now pronounced as going into captivity at the end of chapter 39. And so they're looking at all of this and going, where is God? I thought we were in covenant relationship with him. And he is essentially saying, yes, you are. And that's why you're going through discipline. And you've got to deal with it. But that's not the end, because I'm still a covenant-keeping God. I'm faithful. I'm going to bring you through. There is hope. And there's a sense in which we can keep that in mind as we see things deteriorating in our nation, and we can say, we're probably going through some disciplinary times, but there is hope because we know the end of the book. We've seen it. We know where we end up, and that's the hope that we need to keep in mind. So anyway, that's kind of what the people were wrestling with. They needed encouragement about the Lord's dependability. He has not forgotten them, and that's why he starts off here. Why do you say, O Jacob, and speak, O Israel? He's drawing them into to him and to recognize, I'm not gone. It's not over. We're still working. We're still in process. Pay attention. Recognize that God is still the covenant-keeping God. He does not grow tired. He is still omnipotent. He is omniscient. He knows and he cares and he can deal with what's coming. And that's part of what we'll see in these last few verses, verses 29 to 31. And this is a section that is a favorite to many people, but it's helpful to see it in context here. He gives power to the weak, to those who have no might. He increases strength. Even the youth shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fall. You're going to deal with some of these kinds of things, he's saying. But those who wait on the Lord, that's the key right there. Those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. That's the hope. But it really comes down to they who wait on the Lord. That's the key. He has the means and concern to provide for his people. The Lord has sufficient power to share with those who seek it. So, in all of this, he is not gone. He is not hidden. Those who wait on him, who seek him, they will experience that power. And that's what's encouraged in this regard. He has enough power to share. He doesn't just possess all these qualities himself and keep them to himself, but he says, I'm willing to share if you'll seek me. If you'll come to me, if you'll trust me, if you'll depend on me, then I can carry you through. Even though you are a rebellious people, even though you are dealing with discipline and suffering and all of that, but there's still hope. He's still working through things. And we may feel like we're sort of crumbling under the weight of the pressure that's around us, just like the people of Judah were. But if you look to him and trust in him and see the bigger picture, there is a provision that's available. The Lord has sufficient concern to share with those who seek him. And that's part of what's communicated here. This discouraged people needed to hear something encouraging. That's why the text started out, comfort. Yes, comfort my people, says your God. That's what he's offering, he's bringing to them. But there's this matter of waiting on the Lord, trusting in him, recognizing our need for him, recognizing that he is able. That's why all of this stuff was mentioned. He's the creator. He's the one who has control over all things, and the nations are nothing compared to him. The idols are nothing. The rulers are nothing. But he has all that power. If you just wait on him, if you come to him, instead of trying to find your answers in politics or people or things, come to him. And so he wants us to recognize our dependent state and to utilize his provisions because he has them. That's what he's offering there. And this ought to be an encouragement to us, just like it was intended to be for the people of Judah, because we serve the same glorious and omnipotent God. Different ages, different contexts, but we also need to trust him, and that's the emphasis. Just as unbelievers need to trust God's provision of salvation through Christ as that free gift of salvation, we as believers need to trust him for our daily provision. There's still that trust element It's not in order to be saved. It's because we are saved that we trust in him, because we're waiting on him. We're trusting in him. We're not fretting and freaking out and all the other things that come naturally to us. We need to wait on the Lord. That's the idea of complete dependence on him and a willingness to live by his terms. That's waiting on the Lord. And I know we all have our good days and our bad days, some days where we're more trusting and other days where we're not so much, where we're distracted with other things or feeling pressured by all these things, but we can come to him. That's the emphasis. Recognize he is the awesome, glorious God of the universe. Why not trust in him? Because he is superior to anything else that's out there.